Good evening. Is that microphone working? Yes? No? Divided opinion. I shall shout. A very warm welcome on this cold evening to St. Andrew's and St. George's West Church. My name is Rosie McGee, and I am the minister here. Firstly, I need to make a few housekeeping announcements. The emergency exits are clearly marked at the sides and at the back. That's my air steward piece for the evening. To find the toilets, please leave the sanctuary and head down the stairs, and you will find the restrooms and down the hallway on your left. Just take a minute, if you can, to make sure that your mobile phones are either switched off or on silent. That would be much appreciated. And a few words about the Donald Gorey Lecture Series. This annual event is in memory of a remarkable man, Donald Gorey, an elder of this church. He was a teacher, a lecturer, a politician, a man of many talents, and we are delighted that Astrid Gorey is with us this evening. Amongst his other accomplishments, Donald Gorey was also an international athlete, holding the Scottish 880-yard record. It's therefore very fitting that this year's lecture should be given by J.J. Chalmers, who has won both gold and bronze medals at the Invictus Games. J.J. served in Afghanistan as a Royal Marine Commando. He is currently a TV presenter and sports commentator. You may have seen him on television. He starred as a pilgrim in the BBC's Road to Santiago and was most recently seen driving a Ferrari on Celebrity Antiques Road Trip to raise money for the Children in Need appeal. But why hear about J.J. Chalmers when you can hear from him? So please give a warm welcome to our speaker, J.J. Chalmers, who will share with us about waking from a nightmare to living the dream.
Right, is this on? Can you hear me? Classic microphone check. Thank you very much for a very warm welcome, and thank you so much for coming on what's, you know, a very cold evening. It's lovely and warm in here. Obviously, I'm up against the Johnson-Corbyn debate, so thank you very much. It's coming as your the alternative, not in a political sense. And first of all, an apology. This obviously was meant to happen earlier in the year, but unfortunately, I had to go for some last-minute emergency surgeries. If you don't know why that would be, then you're in for a treat and a surprise this evening as I explain why that would happen. But yes, thank you very much for such a warm welcome, and it is going to be my delight to share my story, my journey with you all, and then at the end take a few questions as well. So effectively what I talk about is the last, I think, so was it 13, 14 years of my life. It keeps increasing, obviously, but since I left school, and the decision that I made effectively at that point to join the Royal Marines and become a Royal Marine Commando. I'm sure many of you know who my parents are, who my father is. If you don't, I think the important thing to know is, you know, what my upbringing was like and why it would lead to a decision like joining the Marines. Well, effectively, it's because I had been raised to realize that I was a very fortunate person. I had a loving family. I was grew up in a country that, you know, allowed me to excel in many different ways. And ultimately, I was always given a sense that it was important to give something back to society in a way that you could. And so when I left school at 17 years of age and thought about how I could be part of the big picture, how I could give something back and use the skills and interests that I had to best use, joining the Royal Marines was a big part. But I was 17, so I asked my mum if I could join. She had to sign a piece of paper and make a decision. But ultimately, regardless of her thoughts on it, she knew first and foremost that she was never going to stop me achieving my dream. And that was the big thing. At 17 years of age, my dream was to become a Royal Marine Commando. It was to earn my Green Beret, and it was to be able to join this great brotherhood. I was fortunate enough at that age to spend time with Royal Marines. And the experiences that they'd had were quite extreme, but they were remarkable. But the most important thing about them, whether that was operations in wartime or whether it was training around the world, whatever it was that they got to do this and live this experience with their best friends. And it was this incredible brotherhood that would look after one another. And so when I went to try and convince my mum that it was a good idea to join the Marines, these were the types of things that I sort of told her about. These are the commando values. This is what the Royal Marines is built on and has been for over 350 years. So the first one being excellence. That's where we draw our line. And I think for myself, it's at the age of 17, that was a big part of it, was to want to challenge myself to find out that if I could achieve personal excellence. I remember at school ultimately doubting myself sometimes. And I went to a great school, and it built unbelievable confidence in many of my abilities outside of the academics. But a big part of it was, you know, listening to the naysayers that said, well, you can't do that, or you shouldn't do that. But actually, this was something which I had in my heart of hearts, and I wanted to prove to myself that I could excel at something. And that was a big part of how the Royal Marines operate. It's not about being better than everyone else. It's just about being the best individual you possibly can be within a group of individuals that are trying to do the same thing. Integrity was at the heart of it as well. Ultimately, we do a very challenging job, a very dangerous job, but what allows us to do that is knowing that you have these people on your side that you can trust with your life. And ultimately, if you look after them, they will look after you. And we were told on the very first day of training, guys, you're either going to pass this as a team or you're going to fail it as an individual. Self-discipline. Well, ultimately, this was the biggest test of my life up to that point, and it was my test. It was the thing that I had to get through. Now, yes, as I've just said, I had guys on my side that were going to look after me and were going to push me, but ultimately it was up to me to get out of bed and get on with it. Come rain, come sleet, come snow, whatever it was, whatever the conditions were, I had to get on with it. And no one else, yes, they would shout and scream at you now and again, but ultimately it fell on my shoulders and I was the one that was going to have to get on with it. And finally, humility. Now, it's a strange one that I'm going to stand here and talk about how great I am for the next 40 minutes or so, and try and talk about humility within that. But ultimately, my understanding comes in the Marines is that individuals in the Marines never brag about themselves. What they do is they brag about the organization. And that's kind of the most important thing, is that in my time as a Royal Marine Commando, when I had my Green Beret, and I still have it obviously, but my time wearing one, I was merely a custodian of that brand. Ultimately, I was standing on the shoulders of the guys that are on this statue up in the north of Scotland in Achnacarry, our forefathers, the people that had come before us that had built these values, and ultimately it was my job to try and live up to them and perhaps even add to it. But this was the real thing. This commando spirit has affected me more than anything in my life, I would like to say, and it still drives me today, and it can come in lots of different versions and it can be come by different names, but commando spirit is what it is in the Royal Marines. And the Royal Marines gave me a lot of things. They issued me boots and a belt and a uniform and a hat and body armor and all the other stuff, but they never issued me with commando spirit. What they did is they put me in situations where I could discover that it was inside me all along. Royal Marine Commando is a state of mind, and you may already have it, is the new advertising campaign currently. In my day, it was 99.9% need not apply. And I was determined to prove that I would be that 0.1%. But ultimately, as I say, it was about finding this spirit within yourself. And it was about pushing you to your physical limits so that you could make the realization that ultimately your mind can be and should always be stronger. Obviously, it can falter sometimes, but ultimately, if you look after it, your mind, your brain is stronger than your body. So how did they make us realize that? Well, the easiest way to do that is to make you cold, wet, and miserable, right? That is the 0 to 100 way to do it. Chuck you in puddles, make you do lots of press-ups, just absolutely thrash you till your eyes bleed, as they would say. And that's when you begin to have the conversations with the demons in your head. That's when you start to talk to yourself and say, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this to myself? And that's when you really question it, and ultimately you come up with the answer along the lines of, well, I want to be a Royal Marine Commando, and nothing's going to stop that except for myself. This is all for a reason. This is all for a purpose. This is all going to make me, a better soldier, whatever it might be. People have done it before me. People will do it after me. And this is what is required for me to achieve my dream. And so, as I say, that's the quickest way to go about it. And that would lead, ultimately, to a career in the Royal Marines. Now, at the same time, it's always worth mentioning, I was at Edinburgh University as well. I was studying to be a teacher. And I had this very sort of split personality in my life. Well, I suppose, actually, it's not entirely split. The values and the ethos that I'm talking about, you know, they underpin absolutely everything I did in my life and do in my life. So, of course, it helped me in my studies to focus and be self-disciplined, etc. But ultimately, I used to find myself sitting in a puddle somewhere going, why am I doing this? Why am I not in a nice warm classroom somewhere? And then I would find myself sat in a nice warm classroom going, why am I doing this? I should be in a puddle somewhere. But ultimately, that was a beautiful balance. I really did have the best of both worlds. And I was looking at two careers that I absolutely loved. I left university. I went off and I worked at Balerno High School as a high school teacher. And that was fantastic. And I absolutely loved it. But my contract came to an end, and it would be 2010. And at the point when it was either sort of go out and look for another job in teaching and start a 45-year teaching career, knowing full well that I could still come back to it at any point. I remember thinking, the Royal Marines is a bit of a young man's game. And then ultimately, it was my turn. It was my turn to go to Afghanistan and do what many had done up to that point. And so I always talk about this as the pinnacle of my career. It was 2011. I was lucky to serve with a unit called 4-2 Commando, conveniently based in Plymouth. And so that was my life. From 2010 through to the spring of 2011, I joined my unit and we began to build up and prepare to serve in Afghanistan. And we knew exactly where we were going, and we effectively knew exactly what our job was. So I arrived at the end of March 2011 into Afghanistan on what was called Operation Herrick 14. Now, the tours in Afghanistan worked as six-month deployments, and Herrick 14 was the one that was going to be run by the Royal Marines. We were going to take over from the Parachute Regiment, who'd been there for Herrick 13, and we would have a chunk of Helmand to look after for 6 months, and then in turn we would hand it on and so forth. So we lived in a checkpoint in the middle of the Green Zone in Afghanistan. Now, the Green Zone, when you think of Afghanistan, a lot of people will think of it as a desert country, and of course large swathes of it are desert. But ultimately, the place where we found ourselves was in amongst the population. And the population were mainly farmers. And therefore, they were in the area that could be farmed. So the Helmand River cuts through Helmand Province. And then the sort of irrigated area either side of it is where the main population is. And ultimately, the population is the prize in Afghanistan. And in this kind of conflict where we're doing counterinsurgency. People call it hearts and minds sometimes in the media, but ultimately they were the main prize. They were what we had to look after. We had to provide a better alternative, a form of governance than what could be given to them by the insurgency, the Taliban, whatever the shadow government was. And so we lived in a small checkpoint called Checkpoint Omar. It was about the size of a football field. It had high walls about 10 feet around it, a big security tower that looked out across the area around it. And ultimately, my job was very much like a policeman. It was my job to go out on our beat. It was around about, I suppose, 5 kilometres around our checkpoint. And we had to go out and protect the local population. And so most days, we're knocking on people's doors and finding out what they wanted and how we could give it to them. And ultimately, what do the people of Afghanistan want? Well, they want the same things that we want, and probably in many ways the things that we take for granted. They want to be able to go to work. They want to be able to put food on the table for their families. They want to be able to educate their children, particularly the young women. And ultimately, they want to be able to do those things for themselves. And to be able to do that, that's where we came in, to provide a level of security so that they could do that themselves. And so whilst we wore camouflage, actually, we were a visible presence. We were always out trying to be seen. like a police force, to reassure people that we were there and we were going to help them. But of course, it is a war zone. And so we had to be armed like soldiers. Helmet, body armor, large scales of ammunition. Because although war is effectively 99% boredom, and what I mean by that is 6 hours of my day was usually spent standing in that high tower looking out across the ground there, and then about 10 hours of my day, 10 or 12, were spent out on the ground, knocking on doors, patrolling, carrying heavy stuff, with not a lot happening. And actually, that's a good thing, because that means that you're succeeding. That means that the enemy isn't there. But you've got to be ready for that 1%, the stuff you see in the newspapers, the stuff that you see on the news, the stuff they make films about. And that could happen at any point. It's a simple pull of a trigger. And ultimately, we knew we were being watched the entire time by the Taliban, by the insurgency. And it was just a case of waiting for that moment to come. But on top of that, our main threat was improvised explosive devices. So they are crudely made bombs. And when I say crude, I mean that they're made out of everyday household objects. So bits of wood, bits of copper wire, bits of ballpoint pen, Christmas tree lights. The explosives are mainly made from fertilizer. But not crude in the way that they targeted us. Because ultimately it's a very, very much a game of cat and mouse in Afghanistan. They figured out a way of hurting us. In turn, we would find a way to counteract that, but they would watch us doing it, and then they would figure out a slightly more sophisticated way to do it. So take the metal content out of it, for example, so that we can't find it using a metal detector. And then we would counteract that, and so on and so forth. So it was always trying to stay one step ahead of the enemy. So that was our biggest threat, and pretty much every single day when you were in Afghanistan, you heard a bang go off. And ultimately, for a long while, it wasn't any of us, but you begin to know that one day it's going to happen, and you make sure that you're not complacent. So a lot of our days, as I say, were spent out on the ground, walking in the footsteps of the guy in front of you. Some days you'd go through fields, some days you'd walk down roads, sometimes you'd go through the irrigation ditches. The one thing you didn't do was set patterns. You just tried to be as unpredictable as you possibly could be, because ultimately you knew you were being watched. But as I say, the biggest part of our job was getting amongst the local population, spending time with them, and reassuring them that we were there to help. And they were very much on site. And there came a point in our tour, about 2 months into it, where ultimately the area that we lived in Afghanistan, this area, Nadi Ali, was pretty secure. And we could sort of measure how successful things had been by 6 months previous. It had been an absolute war zone. And now we had measures like thriving bazaars, people, you know, kids at school, whether women felt comfortable to go out on the streets not wearing veils. And these things were happening in Nadi Ali, both in the south and in the north where I was. But it was fairly contested, but as I say, We were pushing the enemy back, and we were succeeding in these sort of, you know, in this area. When I passed out of Royal Marines training, I was given a letter. I've still got it, and it had a line in it which said, "Congratulations, well done, etc., etc." But the line said, "But don't rest on your laurels." And I remember that knock in the wind out of my sails. I was 18 years old. I'd achieved my dream, and you know, I thought I was a legend. I was a Royal Marine Commando. I was one of the people that I'd looked up to so much. And here's a guy telling me, "Yeah, well done, but don't rest on your laurels." And what he was telling me was that, first of all, although I'd reached the top in terms of recruit training, I was right back down at the bottom as a junior Marine, and I would have to learn a lot and work my way back up. But he was also telling me that as Royal Marines, we just don't rest on our laurels. We're always pushing out. We're always trying to improve the situation we find ourselves in, the people that would surround us, and ourselves as individuals. And so the situation we found ourselves in was that, yes, success, you know, Nadi Ali was looking quite successful. And up north, or just to our west, sorry, in Lashnagar, the area capital, things were quite secure. And again, in the other section where we found British troops, up in Nari Siraj and Goreshk, life was quite comfortable. But ultimately, we had to keep pushing. And so, during the summer, there's always one big sort of operation. There's one time in that tour when basically you're at full strength. There is no one away on leave yet. All the troops have now entered into the country, and no one's sort of left and gone home yet. And I was about 3 weeks short of coming home to go on my stint on leave, to come back from my brother's wedding, funnily enough. We'll get into that later. And so there was this little window where we could go on an operation. And ultimately, it was to secure this area that sat right between us. It was a sort of one area which had no international troops in it, and it had no local Afghan security forces in it either. It was completely governed and ruled by the Taliban. And then it very much was the sort of hornet's nest. Any time that troops had ever dipped into it, they'd been very quickly given the good news and pushed back out. But ultimately, this was our prize, and this was the area that we were going to have to move into. And so at this point, I'm going to show a short video. It gives you an idea of where we were just about to head to, but it will also sort of put into picture, and sound for that matter, exactly what I've described and sort of how life looked for us.
From Loimanda village, we fly just a mile south to the British outpost. Checkpoint Toki is set in a remote farming area in a traditional Taliban heartland. But Toki is no fortified base, just an old farm compound surrounded by mud walls. Ill-designed to keep out the wind and the rain, let alone bullets and bombs. A sort of latter-day Rourke's Drift, with the enemy all around. Toki is surrounded by IEDs, and although L Company's area of operations is small, about 1 square kilometer, it's probably one of the most dangerous square kilometers in the world. Patrols go out every day. It's important to get out there and own the ground, not only to reassure the locals, but also to intimidate the enemy.
I'll leave it now, Emma.
But every patrol leaving the compound will have to play what the Marines call Afghan roulette. Every step a gamble, every footfall a deadly risk.
So, we saw sort of two main locations there. One of them is Checkpoint Toki, and that is where my company was destined to move to. As it said in the video, it's just a small, remote farming compound. And then there was an area of population just north of it called Loimanda Calais, or Loimanda Village. Ultimately, Loimanda Village was the prize. That's where the population was, and that's the area that we wanted to bring stability to. In order to do that, my company was tasked with taking this checkpoint just south of it. The point was that we would move down south, we would take over this farming compound, we would fortify it as best we possibly could, and we'd make quite a lot of noise while we did that, in the hope that all the fighters and insurgents in the area would come south and they would come and fight us. And while they were doing that and their backs were turned, our sister company, Lima Company, who you saw in the video there, could go into the main village and would be able to take its security without a shot being fired. And ultimately, by the time the insurgents would return, there would be police checkpoints established, and ultimately they would no longer be welcomed in that area. And that plan worked extremely well. So 2 days after we landed in Checkpoint Toki, Lima Company went in without a shot fired, pacified the village. It also worked extremely well in the sense that 2 days previous, when we'd moved into this checkpoint, the enemy came to attack us. We called it Operation Tethered Goat, kind of as a joke, but it was classic sort of siege warfare. We landed in a number of helicopters around this checkpoint, or this farming compound as it was at the time. We then moved in at first light and we took this compound. We knocked on the door and we asked the locals that lived in it, the villagers that lived in it, if we could, you know, come in and use their compound for security. We offered them some money in return, to which they refused. They said, if you're here to fight the Taliban, then we don't need your money. We decided to give them it regardless, because we said, unfortunately, we think some damage is going to be done to your compound if we know the enemy at all. And we had about 3 hours to fill up as many sandbags as we possibly could and fortify the place as best we could. And then ultimately, from all the compounds that sat around us, the Taliban came and they started to probe at us. They started to shoot at us, they started to fling grenades at us and do whatever else. And then they would stop, or we would fight them back, and then they would come back maybe an hour later and do it again and do it again and do it again. And then we would go to bed, and then we would get about 20 minutes sleep, and then they would come and do it again, and then it would continue through the night. So on the first night, we unfortunately took 3 casualties as a grenade landed right in the compound. I was sleeping in a small hole in the ground, and then pretty much where the doors are, a grenade unfortunately landed smack right in the middle of our compound, and I woke up to the explosion and the sound of someone screaming medic. I was sleeping next to the medic, and he was straight out and straight onto the casualties. We managed to evacuate them a little bit later in the evening, because we were very isolated and surrounded, and so there was some reluctancy to land helicopters. We managed to make it through the second day unscathed. On the third day, one of my friends was shot as we sort of were patrolling just north of our compound. And although these things were terrifying, one of the things that it did do to give us what we called the warm and fuzzies was the fact that these casualties, particularly my friend Joe that had been shot on the third day, the helicopters had made it to them within 25 minutes. And so his life was saved, and although almost both of his lungs were collapsed and he'd been shot in the spine, he was able to be casualty evacuated and back in the UK 48 hours later, and his life was saved. And so on the fifth day, as we sort of pushed the enemy back off of our compound walls, and we were beginning to see, you know, the space that we inhabited a bit larger, and we were able to push patrols out, it came down from on high from intelligence reports that there was a suspected bomb-making factory in the area not far away from our checkpoint. And so when we talk about these improvised explosive devices, they're completely indiscriminate. And what I mean by that is most of them are triggered by a pressure plate. So you put your foot down and that initiates a large charge. And of course, that doesn't have to be my foot. It doesn't have to be a soldier's foot. It can be a farmer working in his field. It can be someone on their way to work. It can be a kid on the way to school. And so if you're trying to find these devices once they've been buried in the ground, you're fighting a losing battle. Because ultimately, as I say, they're very sneaky in the way they place them. So what you need to do is find who's making them and arrest that individual and shut down the network. And so that was the task of our company, to push out and find this bomb-making factory and shut down the operation system. So on the 27th of May 2011, which is a Friday, we got up just before first light. We gathered around a map, came up with a plan, and about 30 of us moved out onto the ground. We were working as 3 multiples, so there were 3 different call signs on the ground, and we were basically taking it in turns to protect one another as we moved out. And as I say, Afghanistan's all about being nice and unpredictable, and so although this distance is about a kilometre and a half, our day looked something more like this, as you sort of box round as unpredictably as you possibly can to show the enemy and keep them on their back toes. So it got to about 12:30 and we found ourselves about 200 metres away from the compound that we had to get to. We found ourselves sitting in the next door neighbour's compound. It was, it had beautiful lush grass, as I can remember, and it had vines growing over the top. And the Afghans were so welcoming. They brought out tea, they brought out their flatbreads, and we sat there just having a lovely lunch on a Friday afternoon. Great way to end your week is what it was. And actually, it was all just too good to be true, because it had been a very intense week up to this point. And we were pretty surprised that we'd made it through the morning without anyone trying to take us on, without being shot at. But ultimately, that's because we had pushed the enemy back to some degree. But it was also because they were watching us and they were waiting for their moment. I don't know if they knew that where we were headed was this compound just next door, but ultimately, at the point when we began to move towards it, I think I've got a little clicky job here. Here we go. when we began to move towards this compound here, from where we just had our lunch on this little patch of grass here, the environmental started to change. And what that means is that sort of welcoming, comfortable situation that we found ourselves in all started to diminish. And so the locals that were in the area, particularly the women and the children, began to leave. Sort of some of the guys that we had been talking to moments earlier, and we told them that we were going to move into this compound, became a bit reluctant to talk to us. So we knew something was about to happen, or that we were in the right place, and actually this compound was something that we needed to get into. And so whenever we found an empty compound in Afghanistan, a perfectly good building, we tended to steer clear of it, because if no one's using that building, or it doesn't appear to be getting used, it's either booby-trapped, or it's a Taliban safe house, and so they use it periodically. And so we'd steer clear of it a lot of the time. But on this day, the 27th of May 2011, our mission was to go in and find out what was going on in there. Regardless of how ominous the situation seemed, that was our job, and we just had to get on with it. So as we moved across, half of the multiple moved into the compound, so there's about five guys inside now. They search it, secure it, get out the metal detectors, have a look. Nothing seems to, be that alarming. It seems to be safe. Meanwhile, there's about five of us left out in this open ground. It's 1 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. It's about 45 degrees worth of heat outside. And also, the track record of this area had been pretty dangerous. So we all knew that we had to get inside pretty quick. So the last remaining five of us went inside and we began to help the search. So we had security out at all corners, keeping an eye on things. As I say, we had another 20 guys that were in compounds sort of near and around us. And so at 1 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, as extreme a situation as it may seem that I was in, e.g. in Afghanistan, surrounded by conflict, having fought for my life for pretty much a solid week by that point, it was completely normal. It was exactly where I was meant to be, and I was doing exactly what I was meant to be doing. And in many ways, my entire life had built to this moment. And so that was normal. Then I found myself lying on my back in more pain than I've ever been in my life. I remember my legs throbbing with pain, my face, my eye just felt like I had a bucket of sand in it, and I just wanted to get it out. My ears were ringing, and as I began to sort of look around out of the one eye that I still had functioning, I could see the dust settling, and I could hear screams, and I could hear panic. And so that was about the first second. And then the second was, what has happened? What have you done? And then ultimately that realization that I'd been blown up. I had either stepped on something, or something had fallen out of the sky, or the compound wall had gone up. I had no idea what it was. I just knew that, unfortunately, well, what did I think was going to happen, actually, right? All the times that I'd ever phoned home and said to people, don't worry about me, everything's going to be fine, was a lie, right? And my number had been called. And as much as I didn't think it would ever be me, it was me. And so one of my earliest thoughts outside of the searing pain was, what have you done? You absolute idiot. And so as I lay there, I decided, all right, you've got to do something about this. Time to give yourself some first aid. All right, so I went to use my right arm, and unfortunately, it was pretty much gone. So I raised up my left hand to use it, and all my fingers had more or less come off. And so I realized at that point, there was nothing I could do for myself. I was just going to have to scream and hope that somebody was going to come and help. Thankfully, screaming is something that you naturally do in that situation. And thankfully, someone did come. Unfortunately, and I would find out later, our medic was lying next to us, and he'd lost his leg, and all his medical equipment had just disappeared. It just turned to dust. My medical kit had done the same. And of the sort of few guys that were left remaining, still alive, they were able to come in the door, jumped straight on top of me and the others, and began to give me life-saving and limb-saving first aid. And so as I lay there, my friends had patched me up as best they could. They put some morphine in me. One of them said, listen, mate, we've done everything we possibly can do for you. We've got to go and deal with the other lads. And I remember thinking, oh, don't leave me. But I also remember thinking, but they've got to go. You've got to go and deal with that. And so he said to me, just keep screaming and we'll know you're still with us and we're going to go crack on with this. And stupidly, I thought to myself as he left me, do you know what? Bruce Willis doesn't scream when this happens to him in movies, right? So I actually tried to suck it up for a second and just really grin and bear it. And then I went, actually, if there's ever a moment in your life you're allowed to scream, this is it. And it was as if I was just trying to get some release, some of the pain out of my body, some of the discomfort, just by screaming it out of me. And as extreme a situation as this was, and yes, I'd never been in a pain like it, I had been in situations, something like it, in the sense that when I was in training, it was about grinning and bearing it, or as my gran would say, just get on with it, right? And so, as extreme as this situation was, when I heard the words, wheels up at Bastion, which meant that the helicopter was en route, and I knew that that meant about 25 minutes, because we hadn't gone far, I just had to grit my teeth and get on with it. And so that's what I did. I just hunkered down, screamed a little, and got on with it. So the next thing I knew, or I can remember, is the helicopter circling, beginning to hear the sound of it, and then it being my turn to get lifted up, my stretcher, or whatever they'd managed to find, because our stretcher had been blown up. So I think they put me on an old set of ladders or something like that, and they began to carry me out. And I remember at that point thinking, if I can just make it to that helicopter, and it's minutes away now, I've got about a 95, 96% chance of survival. You just need to make it to that helicopter. And I was hoping that the British one was on the way, because if you get to the British one, the first thing they do is knock you unconscious. The record from tailgate to being unconscious is 57 seconds. Unfortunately, it was the Americans that came to get me. But on the flip side, they are a little quicker, right? Hence why they got there first. So it was my turn. I remember the helicopter coming down, the dust picking up off the ground, and my friend, you know, over my body, making sure that some of my wounds wouldn't get filled with this dust, although it was pretty late for that. And then I remember it just being my turn to be lifted and looking up at him, opening my one eye and just saying, thank you, mate. Thank you for saving my life. Because I was already beginning to think to myself, you're going to survive this because you've made it to the helicopter. But the other thing is, I didn't know how disabled I was or, you know, what life would look like when I woke up on the other end of things. And I still thought I was getting on that British helicopter. But I knew that whatever had happened to me was going to be bad enough to send me home, basically. And I was just exhausted, all right? Afghan was relentless. You never got enough sleep. You were working in 40-plus degrees heat. You were carrying your body weight on your back. And you were just always on edge. And I was ready just to go home, see my family, have a shower, drink a cup of tea, whatever. That's my final memory, was just being on the helicopter and then this warm feeling of drugs being pumped into my body. And although I was still conscious the entire way to the helicopter, to the hospital, this picture, this picture was taken less than 1 hour after the blast had gone off. So that was me in Camp Bastion Hospital, which was the best trauma facility that the UK owned at the time, the best hospital that we'd owned, stabilised at this point, and ultimately this scan, which is my right elbow, was taken within 1 hour, because it's timed and dated. So yep, wasn't great at biology at school, but I know that's not what an elbow's meant to look like. That's my right one, and that's a bit of a mess, looks like a bit of a smashed dinner plate, and this was my left hand, absolutely smashed to pieces. At this point, as I say, they managed to stabilise me and keep me in Camp Bastion Hospital for 24 hours. So at that point, they can make a decision to bring you home. And within 48 hours, I was back in the UK. And of course, I was unconscious. So that was the beginning of the easiest week of my life, right? Just, you know, sleep. I've got two kids now. I could do with a week's sleep. But as many of you will very well know, my parents are sat over there, that was the beginning of the worst week of their life. Right off the back of one of my dad's best weeks. So it was the final day of the General Assembly. And it had been a great success, I believe, so I'm told. Obviously, I wasn't there. And the news got to them at about 5 o'clock, I believe, on a Friday afternoon. You know, just finishing up for the week. That not the worst thing had happened to me, but pretty damn near it. And so we begin their journey, and I'll let them regale you with it properly, because, you know, I can't do it justice. But as I say, the next thing I sort of remember was waking up a week later and looking up at my family, looking up at my girlfriend, my now wife, and just thinking, what have I done? Sorry about that. I did feel terrible, all right? And you know, you could see that I panicked them in the very least. And I also remember trying to play it cool. I remember my brother-in-law coming in and me being like, how's the golf? You know, how are you getting on? Handicap doing well? Just trying to sort of, this isn't a big deal. But ultimately, they had a much better idea of what had happened to me than I did. Because all I really knew at the time was I was alive. And because, you know, long story short, my head was in a neck brace and I was pretty much just staring up at the ceiling full of, you know, pipes and all the other good stuff. I couldn't really get a good sense of what had happened to me or just how bad I was. And because the doctors had told me that I'd kept my legs, I pretty much thought, well, that's me, I'm going back to Afghanistan. Because unless you lose your legs, there's nothing wrong with you. It's pretty much my understanding of the situation. So what had happened to me? As I say, well, my legs had been throbbing. Well, they were full of holes, and more importantly, they were full of infection. Obviously, these devices are buried in the ground. They pick up the dirt and the grime that comes with them, and that just gets absolutely imprinted into your body and bludgeons you. And, you know, although I'd made it back within 48 hours, you know, my family were being told that, right, the battle's not over, because this is the stuff that'll kill him. Working up my body as they did, my right elbow, as you saw, had just been absolutely decimated. And so by the time I woke up, they'd more or less done the first fix and they'd put the metalwork in it and kind of put it together with Meccano. And my left hand had obviously lost a couple of fingers off it and they'd plated it, etc. Massive amounts of nerve damage as well. My face had been crushed, my neck had been broken, my eardrums were burst, and I was just filthy. I just needed a good clean. And also, you know, the other thing that happens to you when you lie in a hospital bed, you know, having gone from being unbelievably physically capable to your body just devouring every single ounce of fat muscle that you've possibly got to heal these wounds. They've been pumping 10,000 calories a day into me via a tube, and it still wasn't enough. So by the time I woke up, I was already just a skeleton of my old self. And although I thought I was absolutely fine and I was going to go back to Afghanistan, the surgeons told me at that point, this is going to take you 2 or 3 years to recover from, which I really didn't believe them. I just couldn't understand how something could be that bad. You know, when they told me that you've got nerve damage that sort of goes right up to this point in your arm, then they tell you that a nerve takes 1 millimeter a day to recover. They can then just measure that and say, well, that's 2 years worth of healing just for your right arm alone. And that's on top of all the other stuff that you've got going on. So at that point, I remember sort of lying there, you know, feeling a little bit sorry for myself, I suppose. I was aware and sort of, you know, that I was in the best possible circumstance. But as I came to grips with what had happened to me, the extent of my injuries and the situation that I was in, as I lay there thinking about what had happened, trying to piece together, you know, what I just experienced, one of the things that really stuck in my head was my friend saying to me, JJ, we've got to go now because other guys are hurt and we've got to deal with them. And as I lay there in the hospital, and I had my friend Cass, the medic, on one side, and there were a few other guys in the ward that I recognized, but they weren't there that day. I knew they hadn't been that close. They'd been blown up days either side of it or whatever it was. I knew that there was really only one person from my multiple, my troop of 10 blokes, or that was in ICU with me. So where were these other guys? And so that's when you ask the question. And they don't keep information from you, but ultimately they wait for you to ask the questions. They wait for you to piece it together so that you know that you're sort of as ready as you possibly can be. So I said, where are the other lads? Who was hurt? What happened? And at that point, I was told, unfortunately, that my boss, Ollie Augustin, and the most senior Marine in our multiple, Sam Alexander, had been killed. And so as I lay there, feeling a little bit sorry for myself, thinking about what the hell I was going to do and what was going to happen, that was it. I realized I had two choices. It was either lay in a hospital bed and feel sorry for yourself, or it's do everything you possibly can to get better. It's listen to the experts. It's suck it up and get on with it. If somebody tells you to eat this, you eat that. If somebody tells you you need to exercise now, whatever it might be, you've got to do it. Those are the two choices. And neither of these guys got that choice. Neither did our Afghan interpreter, Abdullah. So why should I have a choice in this matter? Shouldn't. You've just got to get on with it, and you've got to try and be the best version of you that you possibly can be. I was made pretty clear at that point in time that this was going to take a long time to recover from, but also my career in the Marines was over, and so it was time to start thinking about what would come next as well. So my life was pretty well in tatters at this point, but I was still here. I was still alive, and I had my family around me. And one of the things you kind of realize, unfortunately, is that this will do one of two things to a family. It will either tear them apart, or it will bring them closer together. And I'm sure many of you know, I already came from a very strong family, as I said, and as tragic a circumstance as it was, it certainly did bring us together. And then the other thing that really hit home, as I woke up and began to sort of hear what my family's week had been like, was the news that around the country, candles had been lit in churches, and ultimately every day, the highlight of my day, was waiting for the postman to come. And he would come with a stack of sometimes 50 cards from people that I probably will never meet, and certainly had never met at that point. Some of you are probably in the room right now. And it is because, I'm sure many of you have read them and I haven't, my dad's emails. So my dad was sending out emails to keep people informed, and then in turn, the ripple effect was happening, and they were being sent on to others and others and others. And so people had become aware of my situation. And so I looked forward to the day, you know, each day when the postman would come and he would bring the stack of letters. And it pretty much moved me to tears every time as I opened them, or had someone open them for me and read them for me, as I just lay there in bed. But aside from it being, you know, an opportunity to borrow morale from other people, for me, it was another reason to get on with it. There's another reason to think that people are taking some time out of their day to pray for me, to think about me, to ultimately root for me. So I couldn't let them down. So it was time to just crack on and get on with it. So I was in hospital for 9 weeks. I spent about 2 weeks of that in intensive care. And then I moved up to Ward 412, which was the sort of the main trauma ward at Queen Elizabeth Birmingham. It's just an NHS hospital. It was brand new at the time. The outpatients hadn't even moved into the hospital yet. And so we were some of the first patients through it. The ward itself, the trauma ward, it just really depended what time of year it was as to whether it was a military ward or not. It was a normal NHS ward with some military staff on top of it. But during the summer in particular, when Afghanistan got pretty hairy and busy, it would sort of fill up with military personnel. But the room next door could just be some lovely old lady who'd fallen and broken her hip. But we were all in it together. And the surgeons at the end of the day would be working on us, but they were also working on people who had had a car crash outside Birmingham. Already we were in a situation where this, you know, skills and knowledge were being shared. So, just a quick one. They didn't give me champagne every day in hospital. They do look after British soldiers, is what I will say, but it's not that good. This is actually my brother's wedding. So, unfortunately, as I said, I was meant to make it back on R&R. I was meant to be his best man. But with the best will in the world, and as I say, this has taken sort of 3 or 4 weeks into my recovery. This isn't me at my worst, is what I would say. Although it was one of the first times I managed to make it out of my bed. And so we were able to set up a Skype link to the hotel right next door. And I was able to do my best man speech. I was allowed to have like a thimble of champagne, and my wife quite rightly got the rest of it. And one of the other really lovely things was this cake, this wedding cake here. This was made by a woman called Kath the Cake Lady. So when we were in hospital, it is absolute Groundhog Day. Every single day just looks the same. You can sort of tell it's the weekend because it gets a little bit quieter maybe, and you get poked and prodded a little bit less. And that's the thing people used to say to me, oh, you must be so bored in here, and they would bring you DVDs and things like that. But you're pretty much worked off your feet. If you're not getting poked and prodded by a doctor, you're doing physio. I've got scars over 10% of my body, and they needed to be massaged and moisturized 3 times a day, which in itself took about an hour. So that was like a 3-hour routine each day. For my family, not for me. I just had to lay there. But the only way you knew what day of the week it was when Kath came. And Kath would come on a Wednesday. And she was this unbelievable woman who absolutely epitomizes the time in history that I, at the time, had no idea or couldn't appreciate. But now when I look back at it, you realize what an extraordinary time it was to live through, an extraordinary thing to live through. And ultimately, I survived the war. And what I mean by that is, you know, that decade from 2005 through to about 2015, when operations in Afghanistan and even the tail end of Iraq were, you know, going at full pace, and unbeknownst to a lot of you, I suppose, until it happened to me and you became aware of, you know, the conflict in Afghanistan and the real, you know, sort of repercussions of what was happening day in, day out. And I was in the military and I wasn't even that aware of what was going on. You realize that whilst terrible things were happening to us, there was extraordinary things and extraordinary people along that journey. You know, surgeons were learning things every single day. You know, trauma surgeons would go to Afghanistan for 3 months and they would learn 10 years worth of medicine. And that would improve civilian medicine. I was part of a research study that was looking into nutrition and the application of drugs to improve trauma healing. And I remember being part of that and actually feeling like, well, you know, for how useless I am in this situation, at least I'm doing something. You know, yeah, poke me, prod me, you know, do whatever it is you need to do, measure me, feed me, whatever it is. If I can just contribute one tiny thing, then this is all not in vain. But it was extraordinary because the other thing, as I say, and Kath is the epitome of it, is how people just came forward. So Kath would come onto the ward every Wednesday, and she would bake a trolley full of cakes for the injured lads. Right? And she did it completely off her own back. She basically bankrupted herself in the process, and then established herself as a charity, and people quite rightly began to back her, and Tesco started to give her ingredients and whatever else, and these extraordinary things began to happen. But she just saw a need, and she provided. If we went to war tomorrow, no one's, you know, no general's going to stand there and go, well, we can't go to war because we need a cake lady. No one's ever going to foresee something like that. But she was so integral to our recovery in so many ways. And she's just one example of these amazing things. There were a number of charities that would establish themselves. Everything had built and improved as a result. And so I often talk about getting blown up at the exact right time. And so what does that mean? Well, if I'd been blown up maybe 4 or 5 years previous, I probably would have died. Simple as that, right? The medical evacuation process just wasn't as quick and easy and good. People weren't getting evacuated within 1 hour. There wasn't enough helicopters. The surgeons weren't as well trained. Ultimately, they learnt the hard way to save people like me. If it happened a couple of years before that, I'd had both my arms chopped off. And obviously that didn't happen. So by the time I left hospital, I went to Headley Court. Now, Headley Court, it's probably a, you know, a place that you've all heard of. It's closed now, and it's now a new facility, all singing, all dancing. But at the time, it was the finest rehabilitation facility in the world. And again, the reason that was is because it was busy. It's because it was getting used day in, day out, and it was absolutely swollen to capacity, and actually beyond capacity. And people were learning extraordinary things because you were taking broken guys in at one end and you were producing superheroes at the other end, basically. And as tough a place as it was to be, and I was in and out of it for the best part of a year, it was an extraordinary place, particularly because I was surrounded by guys, some whom I'd been in Afghanistan with, some I'd been in hospital with, and some guys I'd never met before because they'd been injured 2 or 3 years before me. But what you began to see was where you could be. I remember hearing the story of a guy called Baz Barrett. He was my friend's troop sergeant in Afghanistan. He'd unfortunately knelt down and his knee hit an anti-personnel mine. And it tore him to pieces. And I remember hearing about that years before I went to Afghanistan, thinking, what kind of life is that guy going to have? You know, how do you survive something like that? And where do you go from that? And I met him for the first time, and I just looked at him and thought, everything's going to be all right. Because if he can get to that point, I can get to that point. And so I was surrounded by guys that were inspiring me. But what was I sort of doing? Right, we were getting thrashed, so it was like being back in the Marines. It was like being back in training. You were surrounded by guys that, as I say, you've been in Afghanistan with or had been, you know, in units all around you. And most of us had been blown up in the same square kilometer that you saw in the video earlier. And ultimately, you got up in the morning and you got on with it. You did circuits in the morning, and then you went to physio, then you went to occupational therapy, whatever it was. And they worked on every single part of not just your body, but your mind, and also your social aspects of building your life from scratch and starting again. And so after a year, my sort of, you know, the greatest thing I'd achieved was building this Meccano helicopter, right? And it was amazing, and I felt unbelievable for it. You know, my hands were a lot worse than these ones now. You know, still years worth of surgery to come. But ultimately, I'd been a 23-year-old Royal Marine commando who used to jump out of helicopters, and now all I can do is build one out of Meccano. So if I'd looked at it in terms of where I had once been and where I am now, then that's a pretty depressing situation. But it was certainly better than the day before. And whenever you had a down day, you just looked at the guy next to you and you thought, well, actually, he's getting on with it, I'm getting on with it, we're all getting on with it together. So ultimately, you were building to something. But I wasn't going to get a career out of building Meccano helicopters. That wasn't going to pay the bills. That wasn't going to, you know, sustain me for the rest of my life. So what was I going to do? But as I say, I got blown up at the exact right time. And so at the point when I began to find some level of independence, and some level of sort of want, and that sense of wanting a mission and a purpose, Prince Harry created the Invictus Games.
Being a Royal Marine Commando is just the greatest thing in the world.
Tom Prince! Keep moving! Watch you now!
I'd convince all my family that the job I was doing is probably the safest job in the battlefield. I loved it. Yeah, I loved it.
Go!
1 in 8 were getting killed or injured. But actually, you still look at it and go, well, it's a 7 in 8 chance I'll be all right. And, you know, I'll take those odds.
Bang, that was it. And I thought, yeah, that's it, they've got me, I'm a goner.
The idea came from Colorado Springs. The power of sport in rehabilitation is outstanding. And the Warrior Games was the thing that really hit home to me. I spoke to some of these guys who basically said, you know, this is the first time ever they've ever tried swimming, but every time they jump in that pool, all their worries, it's like a clean slate. And that's when I realised, actually, you know what, a multi-sport international event for these men and women is exactly what they need.
When you're injured and you're having to learn how to put your socks on, or you're having to learn how to, you know, cook food again or any of these things, they're not things you chose to do. They've been forced upon you. Whereas cycling was something that I chose to do. I rediscovered, you know, the chemical goodness of what exercise is and all that great stuff that it releases around you, but also the excitement and the drive it gives you when you're actually doing it to a standard where you realise, oh, you know, I can compete at this, and I've got a reason to push myself again. It's a fire that's been relit in my life. I wasn't even fully aware that there was actually a huge part of me still missing, and that huge part was the part that the Marines gave me.
It's the extraordinary experience you have with the people you share it with that make you sort of invincible to change.
This is massive now. You know, it's gone from a very small bunch of guys to nations competing against each other.
The Americans, they're the ones we want to be.
There's no such word as can't anymore. And I think disability proves that to you, makes you do it. You know, there's nothing worse than somebody saying you can't do something, especially to a Marine, because they'll go, okay, what's this?
So, back in 2014, none of us knew what the Invictus Games was. I had a chance encounter with Prince Harry at the side of a swimming pool at the Commando Training Centre in Limpston, where I'd gone through my training. And by this point, as I say, my career's in tatters, my body's in tatters to some degree. And he says, you know, effectively, come and be part of the greatest sports day in the world. he had a vision for how great this competition could be, right? We needed a rehabilitation tool, yes. We needed something, as I say, that would get us out of bed in the morning. We needed something that we could push ourselves. We needed to be part of a team. We needed all these things. And that could all be packaged and parceled in the Invictus Games. It was an opportunity for us to put on a uniform and represent our country again. But one of the things he saw more than anything by having the opportunity to step into our little world, our little community, is that we were taking inspiration from one another, and we were driving each other every day through a bit of healthy competition, you know, a bit of teamwork. But ultimately, what we hadn't realized is that we were doing this. It was just getting on with it, as they keep saying. But he realized that there could be a greater purpose to this, and it could be that silver lining that I talked about earlier, that we could take this incredible bunch of individuals and put them on show. We could put them on the BBC. We could really bang the drum and get people to come and watch this. And whether that's someone that has a disability or not, they could take some sort of inspiration and guidance from the situations and the stories and the journeys that we'd found ourselves on. And so his vision for it was massive. And so whilst I stood talking to him at the side of the swimming pool and said, yes, I'll come and be part of it and I'll compete at it, what he really needed was people to bang the drum and say, come along and watch this. Because he wanted this to be seen by millions. He wanted this to have a lasting effect, whether we just did one game or not. And so with about 4 months to go on the lead up to the games, I found myself on the craziest roller coaster of my life at that time, where basically I just held on for dear life, where I just, you know, I would be given an opportunity to do something, whether it was the Chris Evans Breakfast Show on Radio 2, speaking at sponsors, you know, going on the news, whatever it might be. You just had to say yes to it, and you had to turn up, and you had to give a piece of yourself, you had to give a part of your story, and you had to speak for those that couldn't speak for themselves a lot of the time. And I was lucky, I could string a few sentences together, I guess. That's what being the son of a minister will do for you. And so it was my job to help bang the drum, along with the sort of guys that you saw in that video there. And so the games themselves came September 2014. The Olympic Park, this wasn't just going to be some, you know, egg and spoon race done on a military base somewhere, you know, somewhere tucked away in a corner. As I say, we're going to go to the Olympic Park and the BBC were going to turn up and watch it. And they made a documentary about us and all sorts of stuff. So what was I there to do? Well, as you saw in the video, I ride bikes, or I ride tricycles, basically. An adult tricycle, a recumbent bike. It is the piece of adapted equipment that, with all this nonsense going on with my body, it allows me to get out there, get my heart rate going, and push myself again. And so, you know, once you find that thing, once you find that piece of adaption in your life, you know, you realize that there really isn't any barriers. Yes, I can't ride a bike like I used to, or I might not be able to ski like I used to, but now I can scuba dive, and now I've got this bike. So you find a way of adapting and working around it, which was nothing new to me. That's what you did in the Royal Marines. Improvise, adapt, and overcome. Your comfort in Afghanistan was basically all down to how much, you know, how many sandbags you could fill up and what you could build out of them. Yeah, you can keep anything worth, you know, going with enough duct tape and WD-40, basically, if you've got some level of adaption and ingenuity. And so that's what this bike was. I also took part in the athletics on the first day, because basically, you know, I found whatever sports I could possibly do, and I was going to say yes to it. So, for example, I tried seating volleyball, found out these are not the hands you need to play volleyball pretty quickly, but I could do athletics. I will say, however, 100 and 200 meters, I was unbelievably outclassed. But I remember standing on the start line, and they were introducing the guy in lane one. His name was Alain Akakpo of France, and he'd run at the Beijing Paralympics back in 2008. And there I was, sort of in lane five, you know, front and center on the camera, and I was so psyched up that I was like, I'm about to beat this guy, and he's a Paralympian. And my entire sort of, you know, my future just flashed in front of my eyes. I remember thinking to myself, well, I'm going to win this race. Then I'll probably go to the Rio Paralympics. I'll probably win a gold medal there. You know, you get sponsorship, all the other good stuff. So that's what your life will look like. All right, that's great. Anyway, the gun goes, he disappears, and I kind of trundle up the track. But it was fast enough, thankfully, to make it onto our 4x100 relay team, and the other three guys were fast enough, and I didn't drop the baton, most importantly. And so we brought home a bronze on the first day. And so it was a little bit of pressure off, considering that I've been on the radio for 4 months leading up to this, telling everybody to come and watch me and my friends. But what I was really there to do, I say, was to ride my trike. So we had two races on the third day of the competition. In the morning, with a time trial, it's a 1 mile race, just do it as fast as you possibly can. Right? And what happened as a result of that was that I won the bronze medal, which is great. But more importantly, my mate in the back, Rob, he won the gold medal. And Vicey, who you saw in the video a little earlier, he came fourth, split by an American in the silver position. And so what it made us realize is that come the afternoon, when we had what's called a criterium race, which is a 40-minute race that goes fast and far as you possibly can in 40 minutes around a track, we realized that we were in a good position if we just work together. If we just do what we've all seen on the Tour de France, which is basically take your turn at the front, all right, and go for it. So the klaxon goes, and off we set. We managed to get ourselves into a good racing position, and after about 10 minutes, we'd left the rest of the field behind, and that's when my friend Vicey, you know, in the real spirit of the games here, goes, let's lap everyone. And then about 10 seconds later, goes, oh, I'm getting cramp. And that's at that point we realized, this is our race to lose here, right? So we've really just got to play it sensible, all right, buckle down, get on with it. Nothing flashy, just be sensible, which, you know, for a couple of Royal Marines, doesn't come naturally to us. Anyway, with about 10 minutes to go, we then heard the guy over at Laid Tannoy saying, this is textbook racing from the Brits. You know, they are in a great position here, but who's going to leave his friends behind? And when's he going to do it? When is he going to break? Does he do it right now? Does he do it with a lap to go? Does he just wait for that final straight and he gets himself in a position and he does that sprint finish? You know, they were analyzing it, and that's when my friend Vicey in the middle goes, wouldn't you like to know? Because seconds before, we had said to each other, well, lads, the only way we're going to finish this is together. All right? And so this picture here, I mean, this video, this made the Queen's speech that year. Right? This is when the Invictus spirit, in many ways, was on show. Right? Invictus spirit, commando spirit, whatever you want to call it. It is the embodiment of the fact that none of us deserve a gold medal more than the others. And with it being the Invictus Games, well, of course, we all got a gold medal. Everybody loved that. Everyone went crazy for it, except for the Americans, obviously. But ultimately, as I stand there, I'm looking up at my wife. I'm looking up at the guy that saved my life. I'm looking up at my friend Vicey's wife, who stood next to mine. And I'm thinking about the unbelievable journey that we've all been on. But the very fact that this couldn't have ended any better. Because, as I say, I didn't deserve to win this any more than those guys. We'd all been dealt a rubbish set of cards at one point, and we'd played the Joker card instead. Right? And we'd pulled this unbelievable thing off, because we'd done it together. Straight back to when I was 17 years old, and I was told that you're either going to fail this as an individual, or you're going to pass this thing as a team. And that's what we'd done. We'd looked after each other since the moment we were in hospital, all the way through recovery, all the way through our training, and all the way around that track. And that is why we stood there. And I wouldn't have got that gold medal without them. And that was meant to be the end of it. That was enough for me to go away and write my book, ride off into the sunset holding my friend's hands. But what came shortly after was a bit of live telly. So they stuck us in the studio, me and Vicey, to talk about what had just happened with the legend that is Jonathan Edwards, one of my absolute sporting heroes growing up. I remember watching him doing his job, presenting this live coverage on the BBC. He was there, he was talking to us, he was checking his scripts, he had people talking to him in his ear, he was checking the auto cue was correct, he was doing four or five different things all at one time, and he was doing it with a smile on his face. And I remember looking at him and going, the next time I do an interview, I want to be sat in his chair. How do you do that? Because ultimately, come Monday, the Invictus Games is over, and we didn't know if there was ever going to be another one, and ultimately, I'd already achieved my sporting dream. I never dreamt of anything like this, right? This was the pinnacle for me. Yeah, I could go to the Paralympics, but won't bore you. My racing event isn't in the Paralympics, but also, you know, I'd already done it. I'd achieved what I wanted with sport. I needed a new challenge, I needed a new mission, I needed a new reason to get out of bed. And the whole point of the Invictus Games is it gives you that confidence, rediscovers that confidence that the Marines had given me to go out there and try something new. And so just had to make this happen. And I was in such a great position, a position that, that, you know, I would never be in a better position, in the sense that because I'd been part of this big media build-up to the Games, I at least had an inbox full of email addresses from producers and people with at bbc.co.uk after their name, and I was able to just ping off emails and say, how do I do this? How do I discover this? And more importantly, a bunch of my friends were going to become Paralympians, and they were going to go off to the Rio Paralympics, and I just wanted to go with them. And I remember saying to one of my mates, Dave, that would be amazing. I should come out and try and be a pundit or something. And he said to me, yeah, you should do that. You'd be good at that. And a part of me was joking, a part of me was serious. But to actually hear somebody backing me and saying, yeah, you should go for that, then I had no excuse. I really just had to get on with it. And so that became the thing that I relentlessly pursued. And I just, you know, as I say, I went out there and I honed my craft, and I put in the hours, and I went away and I sort of, you know, asked the questions. And of course the Invictus Games came back in 2016, and I was lucky to be part of the reporter role for the BBC's coverage, but ultimately it was about making it to the Paralympics. And so lo and behold, I managed to make it as part of the Channel 4 lineup for the Paralympics coverage in 2016 in Rio, and I genuinely took the job that Jonathan Edwards had had at the 2012 Paralympics. No hard feelings. He ultimately knew that this was a role that was perfect for me, in the sense that I'd lived the experience that many of these athletes and competitors had lived. And ultimately, I wanted to be there to shine a light on them. I knew that there was these unbelievable individuals, whether they come from the military or not for that matter, that had amazing stories that could be told and that could really make a difference in this world. And so it was our job as presenters to put them on show. It's not about you, it's about them. It's about telling their stories, doing them justice, so that they can be heard and seen and make as big an impact as they possibly can. But for me as well, I suppose it was the mission. But the wonderful surprise that I had from it, people always say to me, wow, your life is so different to when you were in the military. Like, you're in, you know, you're a TV presenter now, that must be so different. And it's really not. And what I mean by that is that, first of all, well, look who I'm surrounded by. I'm surrounded by these unbelievable individuals who are doing a job they love, just like we all used to. And ultimately, whilst as a lead presenter, yes, you're at the sort of the pointy end of the spear, and, you know, it's not like my old job, I'm not going to lose a leg or die doing it, but people do say mean things about you on Twitter sometimes, yeah? So you do take a little bit of, you know, the risk, but there's a part of me that loves the risk, sorry Mum. But ultimately, you know you can do that job, and you have the courage and determination to do it, because you know that everybody behind you, if the worst happens, has got your back. And they will look after you, and you look after one another. And I, you know, I take the credit for so many amazing people. I go, let's have a little look at the medals table now. And it pops up on screen as a graphic. I have no idea how that guy, you know, how it appears there. And it's taken a team of lots of people that will never be seen, and their name will just be the little thing at the end of the, you know, the coverage. It's an unbelievable team of people who come together to make this possible. And it's a great privilege to stand at the front of it. And so I came back from Rio, and that was it. That, I had the bug for it, particularly to do live telly. And so, you know, when you succeed at something, you don't rest on your laurels and you look for the next challenge. And so that's what I began to do, set myself new challenges. All right. And the beautiful thing about sport is that it keeps coming round. So I know fine well that there's an Olympics in Tokyo next year. And so, you know, everything is building to me trying to be there. And that is my Olympics. It's as simple as that. In the same way that it is for those competitors, having the opportunity to go and work on, you know, the crown jewels, something like the Olympics, the Paralympics, you know, the coverage of the London Marathon, these unbelievable, wonderful things. But of course, with that, you know, outside of the live sports malarkey, we've already heard about my great success on the Celebrity Antiques road trip this week. If any of you have watched it, go away, or if you haven't seen it, go away and catch it on the iPlayer. Spoiler alert, I don't do that well, but it's good telly, you know. But one of the people, you know, the guy that I'm on it with is Neil Morrissey, the actor, who ultimately I met on this incredible adventure when we did the Camino Santiago. And this was one of these opportunities that, you know, it's a great privilege of television to sort of travel, you know, meet incredible people, whether that's, as I say, at the end of a race, you know, when someone's just won a gold medal or perhaps not won it, and you have that incredible privilege of getting to speak to one another. And this was one of these things. Somebody offered me the opportunity to go and walk across northern Spain with a group of famous faces. They didn't tell us who either one of us were until we arrived there. But I just went, do you know what? The best adventures I've ever found myself on in life are when you say yes and then you ask what the question is after. Right? And that's what this was. It was, of course I want to go on this journey, whether that be a physical journey or a spiritual journey, but it's just a great adventure to meet new people, whether it was these guys here or the people that you meet along the way. And I really did know very little about the entire experience until I got there and just lived it. And we were a wonderful group. There were seven of us and we got on so well. And honestly, it would have probably only taken one person to disturb that beautiful balance. But we really all did get on like a house on fire. And the thing I always say is that you can judge the strength of a team in this world by whether your WhatsApp group is still going many years later. And so we still all talk to each other. As I say, Neil and I went on Antiques Road Trip over the summer. Ed Byrne and I, the comedian, we go and walk the Munros every year up in North Scotland. You know, we've all kept in touch. And physically, the Camino wasn't that huge a challenge for me, although there was a little part of me that was nervous about, you know, strapping on my old backpack and putting one foot in front of the other and thinking, what if I can't do it anymore? But I was delighted within the first sort of 50 metres to go, all right, you've not lost this. But actually to be able to sort of nurture this group of celebrities through it, the proudest moment of this entire journey, believe it or not, is Neil Morrissey, a man many years my senior, who at the beginning of the week, you know, because we all had to live out of these little rucksacks, which for me is no problem whatsoever. I'm used to living out of a rucksack. I'm used to sort of giving my clothes a little scrub and putting them back on. But for Neil, trying to get everything in the bag on day one was impossible. And so he would put everything in his bag and then he'd be like, oh, I need my sunglasses. Oh, they're at the bottom. And so he'd have to pull everything back out. And so on the final day, Neil and I would often share a room together. I was watching him the night before, so not the morning of, the night before, packing his kit and getting it ready. And I sat there like a proud dad watching him as he packed everything correctly. And he was like, okay, I'll need my suntan lotion, so I'll put that on the side and I'll put the glasses on top. And he did it all and he just looked up at me as I sat there watching him. And I was like, well done, son. He made me proud. And that was it. You know, it was a real growth for people who've, you know, they've done extraordinary things in their life. But we did it together and we got each other through it. I mean, there's, you know, for anyone that's watched it, you know, Kate Botley, the Reverend Kate Botley, that she complained a lot in the series, right? What I will say is, you know, these things are edited to look a little worse than they are, but they didn't, you know, they didn't have to use the same clip twice to hear her complain, is what I would say. But she really started the week absolutely hating it. But she, you know, she wouldn't say she loved it by the end of the week, but she, you know, she at the very least tolerated it. But it was very much the idea that we'd sort of got through this thing together. And so she found herself sort of trudging away at the beginning with her head down, not enjoying it. And actually she began to realize that the point of doing something like this is to take your time and to actually enjoy the process. The journey is about the journey, not about getting to the finish line. Debbie McGee, what a laugh she is. All right. Obviously she then went on to do Strictly and all those wonderful things after. And, you know, she's really become, you know, Debbie McGee rather than just Paul Daniels' wife. I used to carry her makeup kit for her because she couldn't fit it in her bag. But, you know, she looked fabulous every step of the way. But at the same time, you know, Yeah, I remember them trying to sort of at the end of day two, I think it was. And it was sort of, you know, she'd really struggled and I'd walked with her. And they wanted me to sort of give the line, which is, you know, Debbie's really struggling, isn't she? And you're finding this really easy. And I was like, well, you're trying to compare a 6-foot former Royal Marine Commando to a, you know, 5-foot magician's assistant. You know, of course she's finding this a little bit more difficult than I am, but she, you know, she absolutely knew herself and she just absolutely trudged on with it. Yeah, it was an amazing experience and it's one of those things that I'm totally privileged to have got to do. And I really, you know, as I say, it really is, you know, a landmark moment in my life and something that I won't forget. And that's why I always finish with this slide. So this is me going for my last surgery. So this would be January of 2016. So 5 years or 4.5 years after I'd been injured. About, I don't know, 30 surgeries in by this point. They're just about to do something to my, clearly to my left hand. I've lost track by this point of what they've done to me. And they've done some extraordinary things, including sewing my arm into my stomach at one point. This is a guy who'd never broken a bone, never had a stitch, never spent a day in hospital. And all of a sudden, as I say, I'm at the forefront of medical marvel. but I'm just about to get knocked unconscious, which I actually do love. I kind of miss that. And they let me wear my green beret as I went in, because my surgeon is a former Royal Marine himself, so he allows me these things. And the reason I always sort of finish with this is, you know, this story has had many ups and downs through it, I'm sure you can appreciate. And I really do hope that you only take the good stuff away from it, all right? And ultimately, the good stuff is only so good because the dark bits were so dark. But if I was, you know, given a time machine and somebody said, go back to when you were 17 years old and tell yourself not to join the Royal Marines, because it's going to leave you with a disability for the rest of your life. And I stand here as a very positive person, but, you know, my parents will tell you, you know, I still have my struggles to this day. It's a cruel thing that my hands were so capable once upon a time, and now they're not quite as capable as they used to be. And it's particularly cruel because I always work doing DIY stuff with my old man. And the point of having a son is that I'm meant to do the heavy lifting. But now he's still lumbered with that. And, you know, every time I pick my kids up, they seem to get heavier every single day. Right? And it really physically hurts. So I have my struggles, you know, and every day isn't rosy. But I've never had a full day that was bad. I've only ever had hours or moments or afternoons. But ultimately, would I change any of that? Well, the only thing I would change is I'd get my friends back. But unfortunately, that's not going to happen. So none of it's going to change. And actually, what you realize, and it's what the Marines showed me, is that you are a product of every single experience you have in your life, whether that's getting thrown in a puddle or whether it's going on the Camino with, you know, these wonderful people. You are a product of the good and the bad times. And you know, of course you can change what's ahead of you, and you can learn and you can improve and you can try and avoid some of these situations. But of course, you know, I wouldn't be stood here today, you know, being able to regale this story in this manner if I hadn't had these experiences along the way. So no, I wouldn't change it. The Royal Marines gave me some of the greatest experiences of my life, some of the best friends of my life, and even the ones I lost, at least I got to know them. They were extraordinary men. And I got to know them. And that was a great privilege, and it still is to this day. So I wouldn't change a single thing, because although it was terrible, it has made me stronger. I stand here with what we call post-traumatic growth, being able to look at a situation that was terrible and realize what positives can be brought from it. And actually, life is easier for me now, right? I wouldn't suggest throwing yourself on a bomb to make this discovery, but it certainly is the sort of the express route, like getting thrown in puddles, to having this realization. You know, having had the opportunity to go to the other side of the world and see what people in Afghanistan have or don't have, for that matter, it gives you a level of perspective. And this experience, this journey, has given me even more of that perspective. And it has made me grateful for the things I have. And I stand here with a perfect life. I've got an amazing career. I've got a wonderful family, surrounded by people that love me. Every day is different. I have a mission, a purpose. I work hard. And as I say, it is a product of everything that happened to me. And I get to come to places like this and speak to wonderful people like you. So thank you very much for having me this evening. It's been a privilege.
Thank you, JJ, so much for sharing with us your amazing, compelling journey, your testament to the power of the human spirit and the power of saying yes. And we will watch your onward journey with great interest and every blessing for that. We have time for one or two quick questions. So if you have a burning question for JJ right now, we have two roving mics. I would just ask that you put up your hand and wait until the microphone reaches you.
Or was I so perfect that there is no question? That does happen sometimes. It does happen sometimes.
So, that burning question that you might have, this is your chance to ask J.J. Chalmers a question. We have a hand.
I think...
Is it on?
Oh. Is it on?
Yes.
It's on. I think the most frightening picture I saw was walking through that field of wheat or whatever, and the fear of every step. How do you manage that fear?
Yeah. So the first time you step on the ground in Afghanistan, you are terrified. Of course you are. And, you know, because no amount of training really prepares you for the first time you step out of that checkpoint. When you do your first patrol, you're taking over from the unit before you. So some of them go on it and some of you go on it. And obviously they've been in Afghanistan for 6 months. They know the place like the back of their hands. They read everything. And so they've got this sort of level of confidence that we in turn develop. But basically the first time you step out the compound, every single crack in the ground, every little thing, you know, piece of grass that's bent over, you just think it's a bomb. And so you are terrified. And I remember the first time, you know, you wear this ballistic eye protection that ultimately saved my eyesight, but it fogs up and you're not used to this weight and this heat and everything else. So you're just a mess. The first time out in the ground, regardless of how, you know, exceptionally well trained you are, you're just a mess. And you're walking along next to these guys that have been there for 6 months and you're just like, how can this guy be so comfortable and me such, you know, so useless? But also a part of you being so terrified. But the bottom line is, you just have to crack on. You need to find the courage within yourself to do it. And where I find the courage to do it was in that perspective of knowing, okay, we trained for this, we've practiced for this, I'm as good as I possibly can be, and I know that the guys next to me are even better, so we've just got to look after one another and get on with it. And you cannot be terrified. Like, you have a job to do. It's as simple as that. Like, you have no other choice but to put one foot in front of the other and get on with it. And it's very all well and good calling yourself a Royal Marine Commando, but sometimes you've got to live by your choices, your decisions. My decision was to be a Royal Marine Commando, and you can't call yourself one and not be one. So when the time comes and, you know, you have to answer the call, go to conflict, when the time comes and the rounds come flying in over your head, you can't be terrified. That decision was made a long time ago. You have no other choice but to get on with the situation. Because if you're not actively improving the situation, you're a burden on everyone around you. And ultimately, your biggest fear in Afghanistan was not dying. It was not being killed. It was one of your actions or inactions getting one of your friends killed. That's what we lived in the biggest fear of, was knowing that ultimately you held the lives of everyone else in your back, you know, everyone else, and it was your responsibility to return them to their families.
One final question. Wait for the microphone.
You said you wouldn't think twice again, you would still choose to be a Marine. Mm-hmm. What if one of your children thinks?
So if one of my children came to me and said that they wanted to join the Marines, I would ask them, why the Marines? What is it they want to get out of it? Because I would, I would not dissuade my children from a career in the military, but I would want to know what they want from it. So if they came to me and said, oh, well, I want to join the military because I want to travel and see the world, then I'd say, well, join the Navy, right? Go off on ship. Well, you would. I want to join the military because I want to, you know, I want to gain skills and I want to, you know, get qualifications. Well, join the Air Force, become an engineer. But if you want to join the military because you want to serve on operations as a combat soldier, or you want to earn a specific title like Royal Marine Commando, then that's their dream. That's the thing that they're going to do, and I would absolutely support them to do it. But as I say, I would want it to be their own decision. I would want it to come from a, you know, a good knowledge of what it is that they're getting themselves into and what they're getting out of it. And the lucky thing is that I actually have an understanding of that. I know for lots of people, and it was the case for my parents, you know, when I walked in saying, this is what I want to do, they had no idea what that meant. But actually having served, at least I have some idea. And it means that my kids aren't going to walk into some careers office and they're going to say, hey, I want to join the military. The guy's going to look at his piece of paper and go, well, we're short of chefs in the Air Force. Chefs in the Air Force, best job you can possibly have. Because that's what happens, all right? They'll just go, and they'll convince them of that particular role. So at least I have some understanding, and so I would best guide them as I could. But as I was told, you know, if it's their dream, you can't stand in the way of it, and I certainly wouldn't.
There are teas and coffees now available for the, so conversations can continue. And it just remains for me to say a huge thank you to everyone who has made this event possible, and especially for JJ for being here. Please put your hands together and show another sign of appreciation.